Hello, everyone. Can you hear me okay? A little louder, okay. Well, welcome and thank you for coming, and feel free to keep eating pizza. Welcome to Research and Pizza. It's a lunchtime lecture series brought to you by the University of Texas Libraries and featuring research by research presentations by faculty from across the university and pizza, courtesy of our generous program supporter, Austin's Pizza. Please hold your questions till after the presentation, and then be sure to wait for somebody to come around with Roxanne, to come around with a microphone. We're going to record it all and put it on a podcast so you can hear it later on, and we want to hear those questions. And also, please fill out your little feedback form. It's on the seat that you're sitting on. We'd like to know how you liked this performance. I lost my place. Let's see. And if you have suggestions for other topics or presenters, we'd like to hear about that as well. Oh, there's the form. See, I can't do it all at once. I'm learning. You can find this book, The Art of the Hollywood Backdrop, in the UT libraries. If it's checked out, as it's checked out, what happened? I hit something. Is it on? There. Okay, if it's checked out, like it's checked out right now, you can always use the pick it up function, and we'll ask the person who has it till June to bring it back for you sooner than June. So please use that function. Don't be afraid of it. It's all anonymous, and we want people to be able to use the materials they need to use. So, let's see. And then the next one. Also, I've made a guide for theater and dance students, but if you're interested in doing research and design specifically, for the theater or entertainment arts, you can always check out this guide. And contact me if you have any information, if you have any questions about any of the stuff you find or you're not finding what you need. I'm happy to help. Now on to today's program. Lecturer Karen Manis is the principal instructor of scenic design and figurative painting in the... Oops, I need to advance one on that. Yes. She's the principal instructor of scenic art and figurative painting for the Department of Theater and Dance, and the scenic art supervisor at the Texas Performing Arts. It hates me. What's going on? I'll read. She'll compute. Okay. For Texas Performing Arts. She studied studio art and set design at Whittier College in Los Angeles, California, and continued her studies at Cobalt Studios in White Lake, New York, and at the Florence Academy of Art in Italy. Very sad. Her career as a scenic artist and practicing studio artist spans more than 25 years, with works held in private collections worldwide. Her areas of expertise are scenic art, Hollywood motion picture scenic art, history, the history of Hollywood motion picture scenic art, figurative painting, plein air painting, and performance design. She teaches classes on scenic art, figure, and fabric painting. Please welcome Karen Manis.
Thank you. Thank you, Beth. Hello, I'm so happy you're here. As Beth said, my name is Karen Manis, and I teach large-scale painting for theater and for opera at the Department of Theater and Dance, but I'm also the scenic arts supervisor at Texas Performing Arts. So if you've ever gone to a theatrical production of any sort and wondered about the world that's created and painted in those venues, it's by somebody like me. So this book came into my life about 5 years ago. In 2012, I was the head of the Scene Design Commission for a national theater organization called USITT, the United States Institute for Theater Technology. And we were programming our conference into the Los Angeles area, and as that's where my scenic art training happened, I wanted to celebrate the incredible work of the scenic artists of the West Coast. Be they scenic artists in themed attraction. So if you've ever been to Disneyland, the finished work is done by people that like who I'll be talking about today. So themed attraction, opera, theatrical design, and film and television. I was interested in celebrating all of that. And so I put together a program a session called The West Coast Scenic Artist. And to populate my panel, I reached out to the Art Directors Guild. And they connected me with a head journeyman scenic artist from CBS for 30 years, and then a head journeyman scenic artist from Warner Brothers, along with my representatives from Imagineering and opera and theater. And that was where I thought that connection would end. But the Art Directors Guild approached me about 2 weeks later and said, we have been looking for someone to write this book, and we think it's you. And so I began a steep and sudden climb up a wall, learning to become an author, and began my collaboration with my colleague, Richard Isaacs, here at the Department of Theater and Dance. He is a set design professor. All right, so there's a little bit of the background. And a little more of my background, as Beth mentioned, I'm a studio artist, but I think most importantly, I am infectiously in love with monumental painting. There's nothing like the physical act of creating painting this large. This painting, as you might recognize from North by Northwest, this is only a small section of it, but that's 40 feet tall, and it's 100 feet wide. I developed my love of monumental painting in San Diego. I grew up with all the Mexican muralists and the Chicano artists that were creating this gorgeous imagery on the freeways, and also the Los Angeles freeway muralists. It was sheer magic to me. So when, at 18, I saw my first vertical paint frame, that's a frame upon which backdrops are painted for theater, I started shaking. I'm like, oh my God, I have to do that. I have to paint large. And so I've been graced with a life that has enabled me to do this large-scale painting, but even more so, pass on my love for it and my knowledge for it to the students here at UT. So I'm grateful for that. So the background. So I want to share a little bit with you about the Art of the Hollywood backdrop. I have a reel that was created for me by the Art Directors Guild's archive. It's been a very close partnership with them these last 5 years, and I've helped them to create the premier archive of Hollywood motion picture scenic art in the world. They have the best collection now from all the interviews that were conducted from this book. So they've been a great ally and partner. And here's our video. Maybe.
MGM had a tremendous capacity for picture, for pictorial effect. We were dealing in fantasy, you know, the yellow brick road and the hills and the odd sort of imaginative type of landscape that we had to paint. We had to develop different ways of doing things. The primary thing, of course, was the backing. What did you have on the backing? And it was fortunate that the first big challenge came in an area that was fantasy rather than reality, you know, the flying monkeys and all that kind of stuff. We had to devise methods and techniques and new systems and new schemes, you know. If it was a question of something costing $1,000 to do in an ordinary way, but $1,500 would make it the perfect way, they'd spend the $1,500, no question about it. It was a get-together, a be-something and a be-somebody and try to make the best thing and try to do the best. There was always that spirit there, you know? It was fun to make pictures, you know? It was just day after day of nothing but interest and challenge and everything else, you know. It was a really great time.
All right. It's so funny. I was watching that. I was almost brought a little bit to tears, and I know that's ridiculous, but the most important part of the book being in existence is that these artists were never credited for their work, ever. They were completely invisible. And so the research that has happened has corrected a vacuum in cinematic history, so much to the point where the city of Los Angeles this February announced a day in honor of the scenic artists and their contribution to the motion picture industry. So there was a scenic artists day in February, February the 24th. This history is so critical to capture at this time because clearly the efforts of the scenic artists creating these large-scale backdrops has largely been supplanted by digital imagery. And so the knowledge is being lost. The artists are dying out. And it is my hope with this research not only to get them recognized, but also to remind the young production designers and directors, art directors, and future scenic artists what is possible in creating a built environment and shooting in camera rather than just shooting in front of green screens. I think there's a real magic that is possible between the built and then the digital. The digital is incredible. The tool is it's so important. But when built upon each other is where the strength really lies between the digital and the built world, in my opinion. But here we go back to early days. So all of scenic art history and the act of set painting and what has been brought to film came from theater. It originated from theater, originated from that style and the aesthetic. And here we have in 1898, this is Millier's, the father of French film. Here he is working with a straight edge on the floor and a lining stick. And if you were to come to our scenic art studio over at Texas Performing Arts, you would see these tools. We still use them, and other ones as well. But this is still being used to this day. And here we have, this is when we head to early California filmmaking. So looking at the origins of scene painting and the style of scene painting for vaudeville shows and theater was very open, very broad style painting. So you can see here, pretty obvious in terms of the painting. And there was really no deception that they're actually inside a building as their backdrop was flapping in the breeze. And of course they're reliant in this case upon natural sunlight to capture their imagery. So very broad examples of scene painting, very much out of the theater world. And this is Vitagraph in the 1920s as well, later 20s. And this would become part of Warner Brothers. But they're still using the glass-roofed studios. And in this case, they were building hard flats, very much like you would find in theater to quickly put together and assemble sets that they could shoot into. And so you can see that the painting has gotten a little more refined as they're moving forward, of course, as the camera technology improves as well. So who you saw George Gibson speaking earlier. He's the father of MGM scenic art. And if you were to imagine the golden era of film in Hollywood and the ivory tower, the best of the best, it was considered MGM. And it was under George Gibson's very keen, very clear structure that happened. He's a Scotsman. He came over, he studied theatrical painting in Scotland, eventually headed to London, worked with the Harker brothers, some of the most renowned scenic studios in the UK, prior to making his way to the United States. He had a theatrical family also in the United States who he landed with in California and worked in theater and worked at various film studios in Los Angeles. He had worked a little bit here and there with MGM and Cedric Gibbons at the time, the premier art director, production designer from MGM. They were having a hard time keeping George actually on set there available because he kept wanting to go off and paint. His scenic art practice was always informed by his studio art practice, so he was off plein air painting. He always wanted to get in another plein air painting trip and another time to study light and study color. And so they eventually just had to put him on contract to keep him there. And he was on a series of 6 5-year contracts from 1938 until 1968 to keep him on board. But if you were to work with George Gibson, you would be required as a scenic artist to go out and field paint. Go study nature and observe how light affects objects and nature and temperature, and then bring your paintings back in for all the guys, line them up in front of the guys, and then they would basically critique you. But that's how to keep your work and keep your job there. And he was shocked when he got to MGM because he came on set at one point and saw scaffolding up against a backdrop. And layer by layer, there's a man painting pine tree needles, pine tree needles, pine tree needles. And none of the pine trees looked the same. It was completely, like they had never actually observed a pine tree in nature, nor were they actually looking at each other's pine tree. So he really, he was shocked at the level of scene painting when he arrived in Hollywood, and he was determined to change that. So he, here he is in his studios in MGM. His first film as the supervisor was on The Wizard of Oz, as the full scenic studio supervisor. And they also, the apprenticeship system was alive and well in that golden era of MGM. So there would be a young apprentice there, and he was preparing the animal glue, and that is to prepare the muslin backdrops to receive paint. So you have to prepare your fabric correctly in order to paint on them. And also, this would create size water, because they were working with powdered pigments that they would add to this glue size, and they would paint onto their backdrops. As an apprentice, you would basically do whatever your scenic art masters told you to do. And you would hope that they would bother to teach you something other than just to have, you needed to keep your mouth shut and your eyes open and observe what you could. In the tradition of this period, you would not be able to paint alone on a backdrop for 7 years. So this is a shot of the historic MGM Scenic Studios, and this would be probably in the 50s is this photograph, maybe very early 50s. This scenic studio was built around 1937, 38, and it's a 5-story building, and it has frames, like I was speaking about earlier. These frames, there are 4 of them, and they're 100 feet wide, and they drop down into the floor so the scenic artist could stand safely and work as the backdrop moves up and down. In this photograph is Clark Provins. He was one of the very important scenic artists of early MGM, this golden era history. He also was one of the scenic artists responsible for painting the dioramas at the LA County Museum of Art in the Natural History Museum. So if you go there, know that these scenic artists worked in multiple venues. But there's Clark Provins. And over here, just to your right, is a very important man in this history. His name is John H. Coakley. And he received this job at MGM at 16 years old. His father, in 1936, had been a scenic artist at MGM, and he had fallen to his death off of a scaffolding. And the family went to the studios for some sort of recourse, some sort of restitution. Nothing was given to them other than a job offering for one of their children. Well, and it's very moving to me to also see that he's working in this space that was built just after his father's death that would have kept his father alive. Because he would not have been hanging off a scaffolding, necessarily. So here we are still in MGM days, and this is a beautiful backdrop painted for Little Women in 1949. And so this would be a built structure. There would be some greens, the trees, that would be placed in front of the backdrop, and that was a whole huge curved backdrop there. And these backdrops were designed to light up from behind, so it looked like they could change from day to night. The windows could light from behind or the front. And it's called translucent painting. And next we have, this is from National Velvet, this little backdrop. And this one actually can be attributed to George Gibson, who you met earlier. As you can imagine, these backdrops are so huge. There's more than one artist on the paintings. So it became a goal of mine to try to attribute as many paintings to specific artists as I could. Sometimes there would be maybe 4 artists. Sometimes there could be 8. But this one, in this case, this is just George Gibson on National Velvet. And one thing I didn't mention earlier, these paintings were designed to be completely invisible. So if you were to see the backdrop, they would have failed at their job. They were shrouded under the secrecy of the studios, but also very much thought of as like a special effect. So, of course, they were on this location. This was not a painting. So here we are in Wizard of Oz, 1939, and I was so delighted to find this next photograph where I could find the top of that backdrop of this film that had meant so much to me and so many of us as children growing up to be able to see the actual edge to that. So this would have been also lit from behind. And this picture took 3 months to complete, and it was executed in complete secrecy. And there was a general nervousness about the color throughout the whole production process. It was not the first color film, but it was among the first. So they're extremely nervous about what would happen. And so here is our full color. And even that yellow brick road took weeks to figure out the color. And they ended up just finding a can from a hardware store down the street that worked out fine on test on screen. And this next one is, of course, Wizard of Oz. And I bring up this backdrop to introduce you to our next scenic artist. Another young apprentice that came on at MGM was a man named Duncan Spencer, and he painted this backdrop. This was one of his first drops he painted, and he had to repaint it because it was initially too green. And I heard it had to do with his colorblindness. So he wasn't completely colorblind, but he was partially colorblind. And here he is, and he also has a whole chapter dedicated to him. So we talk about George Gibson, we give him a whole chapter. We talk about Duncan Spencer. So the history of scene painting for Hollywood cinema is so vast, and there were so many artists to talk about. So we ended up focusing on George Gibson, Duncan Spencer. You'll meet shortly Ben Caray. And then we looked at two dynastic families whose history touched almost every other scenic artist in Hollywood history. So here's Duncan Spencer. He was also a studio artist, a beautiful watercolorist. And if you've ever been to Disneyland and taken the train around Disneyland in Anaheim, that big Grand Canyon diorama, he was the lead scenic artist on it, and this is Delmer Yoakum. So he did that huge diorama. That's a 360-foot seamless painting. And it was painted in 1957 at R.L. Grosch & Sons. And Grosch Scenic Studio still exists today, and they're still painting backdrops. If you also go, again, to the L.A. Natural History Museum and see the big elephant, African elephant exhibit, that was also Duncan Spencer. Here we have Art Rider, and this is, and I was asked earlier by Roxanne about scenic artists and using extensions, so this would be a way for the scenic artist to be able to draw very high up and also get some distance on their arm by using an extension. But here is Art Rider, and I don't know the name of this man, unfortunately, at R.L. Grosch & Son, but Art would become the primary and main colorist at MGM. And so in familiar films like this, in Forbidden Planet in 1956, Art Rider and also Wayne Hill would set the color for the film. So they would pre-mix everything, make sure all the colors were looking right before it was set out for the scenic artists. And happily, every time a backdrop was painted, the scenic artists did a color study so they could make sure it was looking great with the director, with the art directors. And so we found this original color study from this backdrop. So you could really see truly how saturate it was. And this artifact, which is about this large, is now gone in from the collection of J.C. Backings, we'll talk about them in a second, to the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences. So all of the interviews that I conducted with the scenic artists, the last best living scenic artists in Hollywood, have gone into the core collection of the Art Directors Guild's core collection at the Academy. And these small sketch paintings will be part of that collection. And I'm hoping, and I've heard rumors, not 100% confirmed, but there's hope that the new beautiful museum being created by the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences will have one wall dedicated for a backdrop. so you could see them yourselves from the J.C. Backings collection. So here it is, that beautiful backdrop from North by Northwest. And this backdrop still exists today, not all of it. At some point, some of the heads were cut off. They lost that top, maybe 20 feet of backdrop, probably for storage purposes. And it's a pretty specific painting. But the backdrop still exists today because they became part of the collection of a company, J.C. Backings, that would then rent out the backdrops for future films. That's the only reason why they exist at all. Otherwise, they would have been painted over or just destroyed. But if they can make money out of it, you could. So here is actually a photograph of the backdrop only a couple of years ago up on a paint frame. You could see we've lost half of a head here, but it was a full color painting. And here this scene from North by Northwest once again shows a painted backing just outside that window. There are some greens between the restaurant set and the backdrop. And so the scenic artist not only needed to know how to paint architecturally and paint all sorts of foliage and texture and landscape, but they also had to be able to create atmosphere. So when a backdrop is sitting not very far outside a window, they had to understand how to paint it in a way that created as much depth as the production designer or the art director imagined. So painting that atmosphere and air into their paintings. All right, so here we have Ben Curray, and he also receives a chapter. He was rediscovered at the age of 82 as one of the pioneers of the motion picture industry. He was trained in Paris as a scenic artist for theater, did about a six-year apprenticeship, became excellent at the work, and then decided to leave theater and go to film. He worked at Gaumont Studios, and broke his mother's heart because she said, there's always going to be life for you and work for you in the theater, but film is a fad. It'll be gone in 2 years, she was saying. Clearly, yes. So he was working in Paris doing art direction, for lack of a better term. He was doing everything. So he kind of accidentally became the art director by doing everything needed on film. And then he came to the United States, or came to America in 1912 to the request of director Etienne Arnand and in New Jersey. And then he would then, shortly after that, work with Maurice Turner on films as an art director. And he found his way. Here we go. I'm shifting my notes slightly. He found his way... eventually to Los Angeles in 1916, and then he would spend the rest of his life in Los Angeles. He was working as an art director. He was the art director on Phantom of the Opera in 1925 with Lon Chaney, and he was tapped for that project because of his Parisian roots. He was also the art director for The Jazz Singer, and in 1934, he had been doing art direction work up until that point, and then he was at that point working at MGM, and he was pretty much just sent off to the Scenic Art Studios. They let him know, Cedric Gibbons let him know that there would not be more art direction jobs for him, but he could work in the Scenic Art Studio if he wanted to in that department. And so by doing that, he went back to his roots, and by doing that, he gave one of the greatest gifts to MGM because he was their prospective master, but also by doing that, he disappeared. In cinematic history, he became unknown, and only, like I said earlier, was rediscovered in his 80s. But because of his exquisite drawing skills, we have images like this. And this is from Silk Stockings in 1957. And without being able to draw this correctly, it would clearly never work. And here's a detail of that beautiful painting and drawing. And here, I just wanted to give you a sense of what scenic art and scenic painting looks like. It's very broad. It's pretty open, beautiful, very direct, very clear color, a great understanding of value. But the closer you get, the more broad it looks. And this is from the Karamazov brothers, Brothers Karamazov. But this is the same painting. And that here is that little branch I was showing you earlier, just to see what's happening on film. All right. So that young man that I mentioned early on, John H. Coakley, whose father had fallen to his death at MGM. He worked with George Gibson for many years, and around 1953, he became tired of George's very systematic style of painting. He was just ready to fly on his own, ready to create his own work, and he ended up taking over the studios and becoming hired at 30 years old to run the Scenic Arts Studio at 20th Century Fox, which is incredible. And so his very first film was The Snows of Kilimanjaro. And so at 30 years old, you could see him here, and when here they are working with an extension again on that vertical paint frame. And he had a fine career at 20th Century Fox. And here's that Snows of Kilimanjaro. He was also extremely industrious and had in mind the idea of a rental company. So when I mentioned J.C. Backings, it's his company, John Coakley Backings, along with his son, John Gary Coakley. While he was working at 20th Century Fox, he was also partnering with a former fellow scenic artist from MGM, Bill Jekyll, to create these small backdrops in his own scenic art studio. He had a paint frame in his garage, so he could paint these smaller rental backings. And here's another example of one. And another example of one of those rental backings. And just so you know, like, these grass marks were made, imagine a block of wood with pipe cleaners run through them to be able to pull up these marks. And they used fluffy rollers. They'd use any kind of tool they'd need to make the mark, lots of sponges and such. So his life was going really well at 20th Century Fox, and he went off on vacation. There's John Coakley with his crew. Here's Art Ryder, who you met earlier, the colorist from MGM. He went over with him to Fox. And Gordon Butcher, whose grandson would go on to become a scenic artist. You're going to hear names repeat. There was a lot of nepotism and lots of strong family ties. And so John was doing great. 20th Century Fox went on vacation to Italy with his wife, came back, had no job. After Cleopatra, 20th Century Fox had shuttered his department. It was like, we're not doing this anymore. We have to cut costs. And so that went away. So he was jobless and scrambling, and he went off to work on another film with Duncan Spencer, who we met earlier, who was off working on his own, and decided at that time to go in business with his son and create J.C. Backings. And so basically, his partnership with Bill Jekyll, who you'd heard about earlier, he bought Bill Jekyll out, and eventually, and he purchased all the backdrops that he and Bill had made together. Also, when the studios divested their assets, they purchased all the backdrops from 20th Century Fox, all the backdrops from MGM. They have backdrops from Disney and from Columbia. They have this huge stockpile of historic backdrops. It's the only reason why we have some of the glorious images we do in this book is because they exist within their collection. And their first film on their own was Mary Poppins. So J.C. Backings on their first time out. And John Coakley negotiated a contract with 20th Century Fox as their paint frames were fallow. He said, may I rent this space through my business and just contract in here? And so they allowed him to use the 20th Century Fox frames for years. His next film, after Mary Poppins, Sound of Music. I know when I saw this for the first time, I'm just like, no way, that was painted. Are you kidding me? And I've also come to understand in this research that there are backdrops hidden in all of your favorite films, the least suspecting films. They would be popped in to fill in scenes, or if they needed to do a retake, or if they needed to go onto the soundstage for some reason, they would, or if there's a scene out of a window, that's where this one would end up. So yes, they were on site. Yes, they were really at this location, but then yes, they painted paintings of the show as well. His next big project was Hello, Dolly in 1968, and that was where the 20th Century Fox back lot was turned into an old New York street. And in this case, John DeCure, the production designer, had them paint the existing buildings. They put that elevated track there. But also, these were oftentimes flat cutout profiles that were designed and then painted to vanish in perspective. And so you could see, look at that building on the right, the tall one. And then here it is again from the side. And at this point in history comes this man. His name is Ben Rizzella, and he became the prospective master for J.C. Backings. And here's an example of him doing the architectural layout along with Bill Anderson, who would go on to have his own company. If you've been to Cars Land, Disneyland, part of his company arranged for a lot of the painting on that themed ride. But this is back in 1970, and this is on a clear day you could see forever. And they also did Star Trek, 1979. Who knew there was so much masking tape in space? But there you go. And then Battlestar Galactica, 1986. And here, so this is a sketch painting again, like I showed you earlier, of the one from Forbidden Planet. So here's the drawing for this, and then the final painting. All right, so that was just us looking at MGM, 20th Century Fox, and J.C. Backing. So that Coakley family touched all those lines and all those studios. And we need to talk about Warner Brothers, the other very important player in this story. So sometimes there were films that were so large that one scenic art studio couldn't handle it on their own. And so in this case, Ghostbusters, 1984, Warner Brothers, this was a case where there were two competing studios working on this project together. So this setting and that backdrop would have been handled by J.C. Backings. But this one, the night scene, was painted by Warner Brothers. And the feud between the Coakleys and the Strangs and the Warner Brothers people and the MGM / J.C. Backings people was fierce. Even though many of them worked, they crossed scenic studios, and it was very itinerant for the scenic artists. Some would train at one, then head to the next. But when I began this research, they wouldn't really talk with each other. But I was happy to say by the end, when the book finally came out in 2016, we had a big party with all of them in the same room, and it seemed to be a grand celebration, and they're all okay now. I think they're all happy to be remembered and to be able to have their story told. But here we are on set for Ghostbusters, and so you can see this huge sweeping backdrop. All those windows would light up. And this is going back early, 1936, Warner Brothers, and this man here on your left is Vern Strang. So he was the first Strang of the dynastic family of three Strangs who would be in charge of Warner Brothers. This is him in 1936. He was working in motion pictures from the 20s on. And Bill McConnell, who was next to him, he was the lead or charge man scenic artist. This man, Jimmy McCann, he would go on to paint almost all the attractions and lead the painting of almost all the attractions of the 1957 Disneyland opening at Grush. So here we are. This is a shot from Ceiling Zero, 1936. Here is a shot from Petrified Forest. So this Petrified Forest was Vern Strang's first film as a full member of Warner Brothers. He would go on to take over Warner Brothers years later. Petrified Forest, that's Petrified Forest, and then The Maltese Falcon, 1941. Home Before Dark, 1958. And in this case, it's a really nice example of where it's a built set, and then back here where they plug in the backdrop. And so this was painted by Clem Hall, a British man, and he went on to become one of the first Imagineers for Disney. And so here's an example of the painting. So we were able to hang this backdrop and exhibit it. And here we have Vern Strang, older, and his son, Ron Strang, who would take over for him at Warner. And here's Ron doing a color study for backing. I don't know what this backdrop's for. And here is actually one of the fantastic tank stages at Warner Brothers. And this is in 1965. And I had to put this one in because this was the first time the youngest son, Ed Strang, actually got to go on set and see a fully built painted environment. And so you could see where this built environment into the painted area merges, and he decided at that point that he was going to be a scenic artist, and his grandfather wept, and I'm unsure still if it was out of joy or not. And of course, there's the Warner Brothers Tower. I think this is actually a painting of this tower, but the scenic artists were also tasked with painting that symbol on that tower 100 plus feet up in the air as it swung. But the really important, this is an important image here. This painting from Die Hard, 1988, basically changed scenic art for film. After the big financial debacle of Cleopatra and the end of the studio era, the studios, as I said earlier, divested their assets, started shuttering their scenic art departments, and a lot of films were being shot on location. And this film really changed things for Hollywood. This was the first film that brought the backdrop into a soundstage, like back onto the soundstage to give the directors full control of everything that was happening here. So this was a huge painted backdrop, and little lights, racer lights, were pushed into the drop to create the flickers. But from this point on started the next renaissance of painting in Hollywood in 1988. And it stayed completely busy. Could have been 16 hours a day of work until 2004. So here's the Warner Brothers Scenic Studio. Finally, Die Hard, 1988. Women appear on the scene at long last. They started breaking in late 70s, early 80s, and their success had everything to do with their ability as artists and their ability to tolerate the unwelcome environment that they were working in. But they finally were able to swim. Basically, if they could swim, they could stay. And that was pretty much the philosophy at Warner Brothers. The apprenticeship system had died. So basically, if you could swim, if you could fly, you're there. Otherwise, they're going to step over you and get somebody else. But I have to, kudos to Warner Brothers. They were the first to open their doors to women. This, if you've seen Lethal Weapon, 1987, that shot when the woman falls out of the window, she falls into a backdrop that was over an airbag. So watch that again. And they also did all of the Batman films. And this is John Moffat, we could have written four books. There are so many important stories and so many important peoples, but he was the journeyman scenic artist and the lead for a lot of these Batmans, along with Mike Dennering, and responsible for a lot of that beautiful painting you saw in Lemony Snicket's. More Batman, even The Perfect Storm, 2000. This whole set was a painted backdrop. And then finally, in 2004, we have Lemony Snicket's, a series of unfortunate events. And this was really like the swan song for scenic painting in film. It still happens today. They're still painting, but not to this magnitude. This production took nearly 9 months to paint. And it's a gorgeous example of the marriage between digital technology and hand-painted environments and built environments. So you could see here, this is one of the sound stages. This kind of tank scene was set up, and I love all the little teasers there just to soften out the top of the backdrop, this kind of scrim material that blends into the background. And this whole backdrop could be lit from behind. It was built in a huge warehouse that had housed the space shuttle. So they were able to build three full sets in that stage. Here's another one. And to give you a sense of scale, there's a scenic artist. So these paintings oftentimes were 360 feet wide, massive. And here's an example of just that excellence between this built environment and then the painted environment and this foreshortening and the vision of the production designer, Rick Heinrichs, to create this in partnership with the scenic artist who realized their vision. But you could see right here is where the backdrop begins. And I have a great photo from the side where you could see the built berm and some of those little telephone poles off to the side. And even this shot where you saw in the reel with the children walking into their family's burnt house, they shot directly into a backdrop, which is rather unusual. And here's that same backdrop on the stage. And I'm getting wrapping it up. And now we have the terminal here, Steven Spielberg's terminal. That whole set, it was a big, beautiful built set. the whole set was surrounded by a 650-foot backdrop. And it was painted at multiple different vanishing points, depending on the camera angle and what needed to be seen outside that window. And once again, lights were put in. And all of the time and day changes and everything happening outside of the window was just done with light changes, lighting the front, lighting the back of the backdrop. And the only thing digital that happened outside those windows were the airplanes flying in and out. And I thought you might want to see a little painting. So I have an example. This is going to be Don McDonald. He's the last full-time scenic artist working at J.C. Backings. And they still, J.C. Backings inhabits that original MGM paint space, which is now Sony Studios. But the original MGM paint shop is still there. And here is Don painting. And I'm so grateful. He likes doing time-lapse films. Painted for an episode of Mad Men. And I don't know if you, I'm nearly wrapped up. This is from Hail Caesar. And Don McDonald painted all the backdrops single-handedly for that film. If you saw the film, J.C. Backings used some elements or some backdrops from their collection. So Ben-Hur, the original Ben-Hur backdrop, made a reappearance. And so there's this set. And here is that submarine set and this translucent sky. And I couldn't help myself, since I teach here, how can I stop meeting all these amazing scenic artists and not bring them in? So I got Mike Dennering, who is one of the journeyman scenic artists on Lemony Snicket's, to come in and teach an architectural painting class. And these backdrops, this one never actually fully got completed in the time that we had, but this backdrop and the next one you're about to see is on display at the fifth floor of Bass Concert Hall. If you want to see photographs of the class and what they were doing with our students and the backdrops themselves, there's Mike. And then the second guest artist, Don McDonald, who you saw painting a second ago, he came and we did a copy of this little Sound of Music backdrop. So they're not very big. They're only about 12 feet wide. And working with our students. So it is my intention to gather as much knowledge from these artists as I can and disseminate it. So I feel like I'm very much supposed to be this conduit between generations. So it's my responsibility to learn how to paint as they did, but also how to pass it forward for the future. There's my presentation. Questions?
Yes. If you have a question, please wait and I'll bring you the microphone.
Hi, so I'm an RTF student who's interested in film preservation, and one thing I've thought a lot about, since you mentioned Méliès, I know that since his career kind of failed in France because he had those very spectacular sets, he moved to San Antonio to try to recreate some of his own films. Did you come across any of that in your research? Or
I found some early Méliès drawings and sketches at the Academy, for sure, but I don't know about this next era. But I would go, I would dig deep into the archives at the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts, and Sciences. You could start there, but there are archives at USC. Many. And also here, the film collection at the Ransom Center. It's worth, I spent a great deal of time, and Steve Wilson was very helpful in this journey. Sure.
I noticed that you said J.C. Backings had bought out a lot of the studio's backdrops. How do you keep those? How do you preserve them? What conditions do they have to live under?
They need to be ideally and relatively climate controlled, but their climate controllability is basically they have large racks that are underneath. They're the lower stories of that historic building. So there are racks where these drops are rolled onto battens and stored in there. Some of them are rolled tighter into bundles, but that is all of their climate control. But the incredible part of the story with J.C. Backing's collection is that some of the scenic artists, like Mike Dennering, who we saw later coming here to visit, he was trained by working at J.C. Backing's when they had a backdrop that was damaged. They sometimes would paint back into it, but oftentimes they would just rip off that section that was damaged, sew on a new section, and then you as a scenic artist had to figure out how to paint like this master artist who's been dead 40 years. So they were taught by, yes, the scenic artist standing by their side, but also the hands of the ghosts of the past. And that's how they learned how to pass that on. Yes.
So when you say a scenic artist, is he the leader of it, or is there a collaborative effort of maybe five people doing these huge paintings at the same time?
It's a good question. There are different levels of scenic artists. So the vision, the picture you see, the big picture, production designer. In the past, there were art directors, and then it became production designer, art directors. Then come the journeyman scenic artists, the head, or the supervising scenic artists would be the head of the shop. The journeymans would be the head of the painting, and then there would be scenic artists below them. So it was very structured. So like that, some of those big skies for Lemony Snicket's, Mike Dennering and another, I think Chris Coakley painted all the skies, or maybe John Moffat, like two artists would paint all the skies and then have a different crew working on the rocks off to the side. Also the fun thing about painting a big piece of fabric, if somebody's doing this on one side, the other side's doing this. So you have to, that's part of the fun of painting a gigantic painting all together. But so it would be, there would be many hands. And they would be placed where they could be most useful because there are different levels of skill. So there's a lot of kind of underpainting, but blocking in, and then you could build up to the more refined artist on the top.
You mentioned that some of the backdrops got painted over or something like that. So was there like a Holy Grail backdrop that you didn't get to see, but that was, you know, like your great white whale of a backdrop that you would have wanted?
I would have loved to have seen any of them from The Wizard of Oz. None of those original ones existed. There are so many that I would have loved to have seen. But the fact that the North by Northwest one still exists, I think that's kind of like the granddaddy of all most important backdrops for Hollywood films. It's so iconic, and it was such an important film. And the backdrop played such an important role in shaping that set. So I'm delighted at least most of it exists.
Let's thank Karen Manis for coming here and showing us all these wonderful images in your book. Thanks so much for
You're
this
welcome.
Work.
Thank you. Thanks, Roxanne, for having me. Thank you all. Thank you, Beth.